Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
A little bit of something different for the podcast this week. We thought, why not do a retrospective on what is one of the biggest years in gaming history, 10 years ago.
Well, that's it. Because I'm not sure if you know this, but 2013 was 10 years ago. And every time I think about that, it makes me feel ill. This year, Scott, I don't know why. Maybe it's because, as we're going to get into, 2013 was quite a significant year for me personally, and also for my interest in games, and there was so many highs and lows in the gaming world and in my personal life in this year that I'm thinking about it a lot. I'm going over stuff that happened. I'm going over the games that I played, and I'm just finding it endlessly fascinating because this was kind of like a flashpoint for me personally. I think 2013 was the year when I realized I want to talk about games for the rest of my life. It's not a kid thing. It's not just something I did. It wasn't just a hobby. It was up there with film and books and music for me in terms of analyzing it as an art form and getting into the nitty-gritty and watching a lot of video essays at the time really helped unlock a part of gaming that I just didn't know existed, because while I talked about games with my friends, it was like, it was very shallow. It was just like, oh, you played Skyrim? Yes. Have you seen this like cool thing that happens? Right. Yes. I didn't think about them on deeper terms of why were these mechanics good? Why was this setting so appealing? And then 2013, with all of its highs and lows in the industry, all of the games that came out, made me think about games in a different way. So before we get into 2013 itself, I wanted to ask you what your kind of flashpoint was. Like, when did you realize gaming was this art form and that you wanted to make your career out of it?
Well, so first of all, I should have opened the podcast by saying this is the What Culture Gaming podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown.
Hello.
Hello. We thought as well, just as a general wider point, that we'd start making this middle What Culture Gaming podcast slot a bit more of a wider conversation piece. Maybe it opens the avenues to have more retrospectives and things that are a bit more timeless, allowing the likes of the Wind Up that me and you do on a Monday or the Untitled Banner podcast that me and Jules do on a Friday to be their own things, even more than they are. And so why not dive into something like describing 2013? In that regard, 2013 itself was the year I was still in university then. I was doing my master's. I did my master's on video games or art, because that was the conversation of the time. The 2013 was when Gone Home came out, and Brothers. I worked on a couple of other ones as well, but Gone Home was the big one.
Yeah.
No one could decide if Gone Home was a video game or not. And that was the whole thing. And it was, are video games art? Are they not? They got inducted into the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. There was the whole thing with Roger Ebert saying they weren't art. There was the whole debate over whether a video game could have authorship, because it was stupid from the off. You talk about things that made you want to say stuff. That was definitely one of them. Because Ebert's whole thing was like, well, the player authors the experience because they are the ones moving around the world. Therefore, it's not authored by creators. And immediately it's like, but they're playing in a specific space.
Yeah.
They can't make Nathan Drake take off if they want to. They have to play within the confines. It's obviously authored, Robert. And so Robert Ebert?
Well, you've absolutely blown my mind now.
What the hell's his name?
Roger.
Roger.
I love the guy, and he started throwing around that the name guy. Richard Ebert.
Richard Ebert. And we should say that we're recording this very late on a whatever day it is. Because
Thursday,
we've been recording
friend.
Thursday, all day long. Because again, in the UK, it's a long bank holiday weekend. So we have to try and do as much stuff as possible to schedule as much stuff as possible.
And do you know what?
Go on.
It's a long bank holiday this weekend
That's
as well.
That's what I mean. There's another one coming up.
Two in a row. Love
it's ridiculous.
It. Also hate it.
Yeah. And so, but yeah, that whole thing at the time, I was incensed by that. But in terms of a wider sense, in terms of like, oh, you know, you know that you want to talk about it. You know that you want to, that you live by the medium. That was always there for me. It was always, I think about this so, this is such a wider philosophical way of thinking about life. But I do think that they gave me the respite and the purpose that I didn't get from school or like the social circles at the time. Like, yeah. I think I've mentioned on a podcast somewhere that I was like bullied relentlessly for years when I was a kid. So I think, without realizing it, I got so lost in video games and the agency that they provided and the power and the escapism that they give you because I didn't have that when I was at school. Mm. And it's not that I didn't have friends or didn't have a loving family or anything, but I think, thinking back, that's exactly why I fell in love with the medium so much.
Yeah.
Because they let you inhabit these spaces, et cetera. So in terms of, like, you know, you flash forward to 2013 and the massive turning point that the industry took in amongst all that stuff of, like, the wider recognition, and that was, like, the biggest turning point since the 90s when they stopped being classified as toys. And but having lived through all those things, it was like everyone was catching up because it was like, oh yeah, well, they might be art. Okay, they are art. And people like me going, yes, they always were. We've been crying in Final Fantasy VII. We've been loving Metal Gear Solid. We've been, you know, acknowledging all of these things that line up with film. And you guys are finally just going like, oh, these little grubby kids in the corner, maybe they do have a point. And so like, it was just that thing. I was always like, I always loved this medium. I always loved what it provided. And I always loved like being able to talk about it. And I always had friends to talk about with it, with games too, by any sense, but you know what I mean. So I always kind of had that. But I think in terms of being tied to them, I've always had that internally.
I think I had like a narrower view of the world because when I was younger, you know, say in my teens, I always just assumed you can be into one thing. I always thought I was the film guy, right? I loved movies, lived, breathed them, read about them, knew endless amounts of trivia, helped me get this job, funnily enough. But I hadn't considered that I could be a film guy and a games guy.
I remember realizing you can listen to Megadeth and Metallica.
Yeah,
and then just being like, oh, this just enjoy all the good things, to be honest.
Exactly. Yeah. Why am I picking? Why am I like putting myself in this lane when I love this other thing and it has the same depth and complexity and desire for me to pick it apart? So this 2013 was the year when I realized, oh, my identity isn't just built around one thing that I like. No one cares about that. You know, do things for the love of it, do things for the thrill of it, do things because you enjoy it. And I realized then that I have this burning desire that annoys you every single day of your life.
It makes my life.
To love video games and
I think, was going to also say that 2013 was the year that I started What Culture. It was October 2013.
Of course.
So that whole year and the year previous, like I said, I was doing my master's, you know, coming out of having been at university for like 3 years or whatever at that point. And so I was trying to write online. I was a music guy back then. Not that I ever gave up on gaming whatsoever. It was always there. But I was trying to be a music journalist. I was literally interviewing bands. I was trying to write up reviews. I was doing articles for websites and everything, trying to get that off the ground. And it wasn't until I shifted onto gaming, which was always there, that everything started working. And all of a sudden, they would take more articles. There were less people trying to be games writers back in 2013 in the online space, or whatever you want to say. And then What Culture was, you know, listed as a place that would do that as well. And I just sort of like pivoted across and started doing What Culture stuff. My early stuff is a mix of music and gaming. And then the gaming stuff just flew so much more. And it was just, there was just so much to talk about. And there's so much to fight for. Or like, and like I said, especially in that time, it was, you know, conversations on ludonarrative dissonance, which had happened back when GTA 4 came out.
Yep.
But things that came back around in terms of, well, ludonarrative dissonance, oh my God, the 30-second version, the idea of playing a game in a way that breaks the way that it's written. So like Niko Bellic in GTA 4 is always the classic example because he's complaining that he has to be drawn back into a life of crime. But in between missions, you could just take a rocket launcher to a grandma's face.
Yes.
And then go to the next cutscene and he would immediately be like, I don't want any more violence than's necessary. That was a whole conversation in itself as well. So for me, that whole spark that was at the beginning of the 2010s was just so easy to get stuck into and be like, no, this needs to be said. You guys are missing out on this,
yep,
et cetera.
Well, that was it, man. Like 2013 was the first year that I took notice of the industry. I always was on the hype cycles. I always tuned in for E3 and the like.
Same.
But I never kind of got into the nitty gritty of, you know, developers over-promising, vertical slices or all of the stuff that we talk about today. But because 2013 had so many high high-profile disasters and stories, as well as it had great games. You know, I'm looking at Aliens Colonial Marines, which came out that year.
I was going to open on that, and I thought that might break you, so I want to remind you that straight away.
That is part of my origin story, because that was the most my most anticipated game of all time, so to watch that burn was crazy. You know, all the discussions around The Last of Us, Bioshock Infinite, the backlash to DMC, Devil May Cry, all that stuff was novel to me. I hadn't seen that kind of peek behind the curtain, as it were, in terms of the industry ever before, just because I hadn't looked for it. And then, like I said, all of these video essays, kind of a pivot to YouTube, got me more aware of that stuff. But before we continue, I just want to kind of contextualize 2013 for people who may not remember.
Please do.
May not have been around for 2013 or involved in gaming for 2013, because this was the year where the new console generation was about to begin. The PS4 and the Xbox One was about to drop. Mm-hmm. And at the time, everyone was kind of saying, consoles are dead. These things are not going to sell. Mobile is the future. Obviously, that was proven wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of the end of an era for me, 2013, because you have a bunch of high-profile disasters. Like I said, you also have Dead Space 3 coming out this year. Mm. You have the rise of Outlast, which dropped this year. So you've kind of got
Arkham Origins as well.
Arkham Origins. You've got like the end of certain narratives in the gaming space. You know, big publishers saying horror doesn't sell. Everything needs to be action-focused. That was more or less proven dead here. You've got mobiles of the future, consoles, nobody wants them, proven wrong. Mm-hmm. And you have huge successes like GTA 5. I just think in that term, it kind of feels like we've been living in the shadow of 2013 for the past 10 years in a way that I never felt previously. It did feel like an end of an era and the beginning of a new one, and that's not just because new consoles came out, but it felt like all the narratives around the trends and the design ethoses and the franchises of the time were kind of pivoting or changing.
I always thought that, like, we had this conversation years ago on the podcast about, like, when was the last time we had a new genre? When was the last time that we had a new gameplay mechanic? And obviously there's been Battle Royale, you know, there's been Fall Guys, like, well, there's been various things that played a bit differently over in an overarching sense, not just, oh, you have access to a certain specific mechanic. But when you go back to, that's why I always kind of romanticize and then kind of catch myself doing it, the 2000s and the early 2010s in terms of, like, the amount of games that were coming out. But to be honest, like, when you go back and look at 2013, like, it was wall-to-wall insane quality. This isn't even everything, but just to run stuff down, we can revisit them if you've got them written down as well. But this is just off the top of my head, and then I went back and just looked at, like, a wider list. But yeah, GTA 5, The Last of Us, Bioshock Infinite, Assassin's Creed Black Flag, Stanley Parable, The Tomb Raider Reboot, Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, Gone Home, XCOM Enemy Within, Splinter Cell Blacklist, Batman Arkham Origins, Gears Judgment, Saints 4, and DMC Devil May Cry. And also, like I said, the explosion of indie games. Papers, Please, Hotline Miami came to Mac. That was when I finally played Hotline Miami.
Yeah,
I didn't have it on PC. Gone Home, I mentioned Stanley Parable, Rogue Legacy, and then Flower came to PlayStation 4. Ridiculous.
I think it's fascinating just how many of those games are not only talked about today, but still sell well today. Mm-hmm. This year alone, we've seen, obviously, The Last of Us TV show. Mm-hmm. That, as a franchise, was established 10 years ago. It's bigger than ever. It just got a remake last year. The Last of Us is eternal. I just saw this week that GTA 5 was back in the top 10 sales for the UK. It's been 10 years since GTA 5. The shadow of that thing is not even a shadow. Enough. It's still present. It's still there. It's still selling, and it's 10 years old.
There must be enough. Well, that's the thing. On a 10-year gap, enough people have aged to become 18 to buy it legally, or have aged to the point where GTA is on their radar, and a whole new generation of people buy it again. We've rarely ever had that in gaming. Like, that's a weird thing. I know it's not specific to this year, but the idea of multi-decade-long franchises that, from third parties, the likes of GTA, the likes of Call of Duty, it used to nearly always only be the Nintendos that stuck around, Sega with Sonic or something. But, like, the idea of being able to, it's not that Rockstar have, like, watered those plants in a while, but, you know, Call of Duty's still very much going strong, and that's been carried over for, like, two decades. But yeah, that whole thing of, like, 2013 being the time when everything was, like, flying, all systems go kind of thing. That is interesting that was the last time we had such a variety of stuff.
Yeah.
And everything that I just reeled off there, I don't think any of them came in hot. Like, I remember Arkham Origins being a little bit buggy, but for the vast majority of the games that I mentioned there, they all came in very playable, immediate. The idea that a game couldn't work on launch day was not a thing.
Like, yeah.
You bought it, you played it, the patches were kilobytes big. That was it.
That very much kind of came into its own with the arrival of the PS4 and the Xbox One, wasn't it? Like, one of the first games, one of the launch games, actually, for at least the PlayStation 4, was Battlefield 4.
Yep.
And because that famously was, you know, released on every single console imaginable and DICE was really struggling to get all of those versions working, the servers were botched at launch. It took them ages to fix it. But before then, like you said, you know, you got GTA 5, which, yes, the online component was a little bit busted, but the main single-player game worked. The Last of Us, obviously, was a pristine experience, and all of those indie games you mentioned were really fascinating as well.
You know, you mentioned, like, living in the shadow of something. Like, gaming has never shaken that feeling from 2014. I remember those conversations around Assassin's Creed Unity, Battlefield, like you said, just that whole thing of, like, oh, is this what games are now? Because the projects are bigger, the money is bigger. We've never got away from that. The only thing that's changed, quote-unquote, is more money invested and bigger disasters, like Redfall or whatever it is. 2013 might be the last year that gaming was safe.
Interesting.
In terms of, like, the assumption that you're just going to buy something and play it.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, now it's always like, okay, but what state's it in? Let me watch a Digital Foundry video and make sure it's actually going to run well. Because, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's why we keep saying things are in the shadow of, like, these things. But I view 2013 as the industry planting seeds for the next 10 years. Like, those franchises and those games that still dominate today. The pivot to indies that you mentioned. You know, people wondering whether Gone Home was even a video game at all, which seems, like, crazy in hindsight, considering how diversified the indie space is. Stuff like Papers, Please, which was taking a more political, overtly political stance, you know, eventually leading to maybe something like Disco Elysium being able to be so popular and not have the argument of, is this really a video game surrounding it? I just wonder whether we will ever live through, when we almost certainly will, another period where we see these seeds getting planted again, because everything since then, again, in my opinion, has been a spring off from that. You might look at live services and Destiny, which obviously came a few years after, but even the start of that was in GTA Online. The idea that this was going to be like a live service thing that was supported for a long time. Players were going to be playing in the same space, either PvP or PvE. Things were going to evolve.
The first season pass was
Rockstar. Yeah, exactly that. We got like Dead Space 3 introducing microtransactions, which obviously led to an absolute disaster a few years later, but you've got all of these things that have kind of branched off now, and I wonder whether we'll ever get to the point where it seems like it did in 2013, that the industry was almost heading for disaster. It was going to radically change. People didn't really know how it was going to change. A lot of people were betting on mobile, like I said, but they were planting the seeds for what was to come. I just don't ever see us getting to that point again. The industry kind of seems too big and trends almost too set in stone to kind of endure through that revolution. We did a video the other day positing the question of, has this generation been a disaster? We got some lovely responses from people on Twitter, and I think we kind of talked about in there that every generation since 2013 and the introduction of the PS4 has felt more iterative than it has. What's the opposite of iterative? like a big revolution, fresh, a big overhaul, if that makes sense.
Well, that's kind of the thing with trying to, like, you know, nail down what were the biggest changes in gaming and going back to 2013 and the influx of indie storytelling, as much as, like, production budgets changed. I remember everybody getting sick of pixel platformers. I remember that being the thing that you could just write off a whole game if it was pixelated at all. Whereas, like, now that's just settled into, it's an art style. You know, games can release with beautiful pixel art and not necessarily be a platformer or not necessarily be, you know, whatever it is. I feel like 2013 for me, and like I said, I did my whole dissertation thing on it at the time. It's something that I was so invested in. One of the first things I ever wrote for What Culture was 10 reasons video games are art.
Right.
Like, I'm just going to stay to this for whoever's reading this, because I need to get this out. But the maturation of the medium can be, you know, there was such a point there where previously you had things like BioShock, like the whole way that game sort of plays with agency, all the would you kindly stuff and whatever. Then you had GTA 4 and the ludonarrative dissonance stuff. You had these little attempts at maturing what the medium could be. But then in 2013, when you had that conversation around authorship and or authorship and whether they belong in the Museum of Modern Art and all that kind of stuff, because we won, quote unquote, and because everyone accepted that obviously these are well-written or these are well-framed stories, narratives, immersive experiences, it led to God of War 2018 or Uncharted 4 or whatever you want to say about the more mature stuff that Sony puts out now. And those experiences, like those games, I don't believe you would have them if the Ken Levines of the world or whoever hadn't made those leaps in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talk about this game to death, but there is a reason for it. You look at something like The Last of Us. Obviously,
Spec Ops the line.
Well, we do talk about that game to death as well.
1 year prior.
No, The Last of Us. Everyone knows how that game influenced games and culture. You know, what it introduced, that kind of style of storytelling, that new approach to implementing a companion character that, yes, was in Bioshock Infinite, but was done, in my opinion, way better in The Last of Us. But I think there are other reasons that game pushed the medium forward that don't get enough credit. You know, we've talked about it when we were talking about The Last of Us show, but like even the ability to put Ellie on the cover of the game, which got pushed back at the time. Like, you can't put like a teenage girl in the game. No one buys
Where's
video games for that. You cut forward 10 years and the part one remake has Ellie front and center. You know, she's bigger than Joel. Those little battles for representation, or like I said, different approaches to stories. Can we tell human stories about human people and look at characters and protagonists that, you know, don't often get the spotlight? I think that the seeds of that were kind of here. It's still not perfect today, of course, but definitely stuff like The Last of Us has obvious implications on the industry going forward, but it also has those kind of subtle ones that you kind of like don't even know about unless you've read a bunch of interviews and realized that that was an issue to begin with, because you just kind of take it for granted, I suppose, and don't even think about it.
There's a weird knock-on effect, because you were saying about, like, you know, will we live through another planting of the seeds, a similar seed, something that would expand what gaming is yet again. I think it's an interesting talking point, where, because I love every single game I've just reeled off. I love 2013 overall as a gaming year, and I love what gaming means overall and the amount of different things. Like, for me, I think I must have said this on a podcast or a recording, but I do think gaming or video games is like the ultimate medium.
Yeah.
Like, if you're into architecture, you can apply that to level design. If you're into script writing, you can do that. You can film cutscenes cinematographically or whatever. Like, for me, it's the everything. You know, why not? You can achieve whatever you want in that space. However, I think it's an interesting talking point, and I don't necessarily side with this, that the more we moved into thematic territory and storytelling territory, the more you get away from video games. You know, you get away from what the medium is. And it's like, if you had a movie that released with an interactive component where you had to play along to get the story to finish.
Black Mirror, Bandersnatch.
Right, yeah. Like, that's like a weird, like, trying to walk the line. But I mean, like, a proper cinematic experience where they ask you to take part. Would people like that or not? Is that blurring the lines too much? And that whole thing of, you know, gameplay being minimized in favor of weighty thematics or whatever it is, like memorable storytelling. Like, obviously those stories are memorable. I love God of War 2018, but something like God of War Ragnarok was a little bit too iterative on the gameplay side, and its biggest strides were made through storytelling.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting in terms of where we are, because I don't know what you do to, I don't necessarily think you need to invert that, but I did play through, I think I said this when we did this the other month, play through the Atari 50 collection. And there's a lot of games from the 70s that still play phenomenally well, are super addictive, are super fun, and are fundamentally video games.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting as a talking point on, like, can you have both? Or the industry for so long, was obsessed with chasing Hollywood because of Metal Gear Solid. And once Kojima openly said he wanted to be a film director and then just made a game that was shot like a film, we chased that so much.
Yes.
And we've proven we can do it now. And now Hollywood is adapting all of these games that are more cinematically focused. And I'm just curious, like, can we just make games again?
It's funny that, because 2013 was the year that Beyond Two Souls released. You know, David Cage really striving for that cinematic approach to validate the medium. But I completely agree with what you said there. I love cinematic games. I love Naughty Dog games. I love God of War Ragnarok. But I think those games work best. And I think those developers actually know that those games work best when you are playing to the strengths of it being a video game. You know, briefly going back to The Last of Us, that game's story works so well in the end, as we always talk about, because, you know, right at the end, after kind of choosing what Joel does and how you take people out, you don't get the choice through gameplay to kill that doctor right at the very end. And that kind of, you know, makes you realize that the character that you've been controlling, that you might have projected yourself onto, is a person that has his own agency kind of away from you, and it wrangles with the controls in that way. I think The Last of Us Part 2 works primarily as a video game, and I think its video game-ness in terms of its structure and swapping between characters and getting you familiar with characters through gameplay and through, you know, ambient dialogue and stuff is going to struggle to be adapted to a TV show because that format and that structure just wouldn't work as well if you're not controlling the characters. And, you know, you go back to 2013, you have stuff like the Stanley Parable, which obviously draws narrative out of this kind of meta framing of it knows what you're going to do and it has this open conversation with the player. I think 2013, and maybe a little bit before, is when we kind of get that meta focus of, okay, gamers are familiar with how games are made, or at least the kind of bare mechanics of them. We can start having fun with that. We can start playing into their assumptions and expectations and twist them to, in a way that video games only can.
It cannot be understated how much BioShock fractured the entire industry in the best way possible. I will always remember, I was driving home from when I used to work in Argos, which is like a retail chain in the UK. I was driving home after a late shift, and I remember listening to Greg Miller back when he was on the IGN podcast Beyond, when he used to cover PlayStation for IGN. And he just played, he'd finished BioShock, and he couldn't say anything because he was embargoed, but he was trying to convey, obviously what we now know is the would you kindly twist to the rest of the guys that were on that podcast. And he was so overwhelmed with what that game had done. And I just always, I'll always remember everything that came out of that conversation and everything that came out of that game, because all of a sudden it was like, well, why does Sonic collect rings? Why is Mario getting coins? Why introducing the idea of why into gaming opened everything up. Because if you go back to any older game, it was like, well, that's the evil dude and go kill the evil dude. Well, why is he evil? What's going on? Oh, you know, as soon as you introduce that element, you have to justify things more. You have to mature it more. You have to make it more than it was. And for me, the linchpin is BioShock. Even though 2013 carried on, I feel like the indie space came from those conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they had so much more to flesh out.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But Hotline Miami is fundamentally a response to why do what, you know, we enjoy the violence of video games and making a game about that. But yeah, I just want to throw that in, that like BioShock was seismic AF.
Hell
as
yeah.
Much as the would you kindly twist is driven into the ground now. At the time, it was unbelievable, and then realizing what the journalists were referring to, and then being like, and then having, that's the thing you can't replicate. When that twist drops and you realize how much you have been taken advantage of, that's a very, very hard thing to replicate, and only gaming could do that as well.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, even its own sequels are living in like the shadow of BioShock. Like what, like you said, it just kind of broke what players expected from a game. Mm-hmm. It broke and changed the conversations that players had with the game itself. Mm-hmm. And I think BioShock Infinite coming out in 2013 and trying so hard to replicate that, and initially seemingly succeeding with incredible reviews, but then not having the staying power that the first game had, I think is fascinating. You know, that was one of the best rated games of that year.
Yes.
But we don't talk about Infinite the same way that we talk about The Last of Us, GTA 5, Gone Home, Hotline Miami, that we still do today. And I think like it's
Yeah. It felt weird, right? Because when I remember when Infinite dropped, because I did a magazine design module when I was in university, and that wasn't out yet, but we had to design something we were looking forward to. So I made a whole fake game magazine with that on the front of it. I was like really psyched for that, for Bioshock Infinite. But it was a weird thing with that game where it felt like a big twist at the end was almost formulaic, even though it was just the third one. It was just, okay, what are you going to do this time? Because the Would You Kindly thing was everywhere. And then looking back on it, like obviously at the time it was talked about, but the whole way that Ken Levine was trying to address the franchising of Bioshock, and just, you know, there's always a lighthouse, there's always a man or whatever. That could have been a really poignant comment on a forced return to somewhere. And like people did get that from Bioshock Infinite, but I didn't. I always just thought that was a bit forced. Like they were trying to invert everything too much, and like the Comstock stuff and everything. And I was like, this is too crazy. You're trying to wow me way too much. Whereas the more subtle twist of with the Lutece twins and the he doesn't row, that if you know, you know, but the he doesn't row line when you have full context is one of my favorite subtle twists ever in a game.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, here's the thing about Bioshock Infinite, right? All of the games that we've mentioned so far, I would go back and replay. I am so scared to replay Bioshock Infinite because I loved it so much at the time.
Right.
It dropped at the perfect period for me. I was just getting into games. Mm. I was just realizing that they could have this extra layer. They could be meta commentaries. They could talk about franchises as a whole and creative cycles as a whole. And I got it just after I got broken up with. It was my breakup game and I hammered it. No, bad in one way, but great because
using
it was
the sky
like
hook to punch everything.
I was just taking my anger out in my frustration and my sadness out on like these racists in this game. And I was like, yeah, at least I've got agency here. I could be happy in this world maybe if I'm not accidentally playing a terrible guy who in a multiverse is the worst guy in the world.
You didn't know that at the time.
You didn't know that at the time. But the point is, like, I worry that the themes of that game won't hold up today. Obviously, there was so many conversations about the depiction of some of the characters in that game and some of the ideas in that game that, you know, people had problems with then, and I was a bit too young to fully grasp at the time. Yeah. But the thing that I still genuinely will like is what you just said there, that final twist of the lighthouses and how it's a commentary on, like, there's always a lighthouse, there's always a guy. This is the formula of the franchise, and we're making that subtext text now, and bless you if you want to make another Bioshock, because we've now closed that up.
Yeah.
And if you do it, you'll be admitting that it's just another one in this like grand, you know, multiversal kind of thing. I still, even if the logic might not be there, I still like that idea.
I'm going to make a horrific comparison for some people, but it reminds me of the, have you seen the scene in She-Hulk where she meets the Kevin Feige robot?
I have not,
actually. That's very much the same energy. And in terms of Infinite, obviously, and that's one of the best mic drops for an auteur to do. That's also another thing, and I know we're going to wrap this up like soon or whatever.
Well, you think that. I've got another thing I want to talk to you about.
We shall. But the whole era of the auteur, that has very much gone away. There are various talking pieces, commentary pieces, done on how much we empowered the auteur in gaming, the Hideo Kojimas, the Ken Levines, the John Romeros, whoever it is. And it's not that they didn't help facilitate incredible video games, but did that lead to some tyrannical decisions? All you need to do is read into Team Bondi. And something McNamara is the dude that ran that studio for L.A. Noire, and that guy was an absolute monster, at least according to the reports that are written about him. But that whole thing of, like, you know, we point to a certain creator and go, I have faith in this IP because that guy's putting it together.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really happen that much now. Kojima's one of the only ones left. We tend to think of the companies as the auteurs now, which is like there is a Sony identity now, which works in their favor, but we don't really have the auteurs. The reason I mention She-Hulk, though, is that idea of once you acknowledge the auteur, once you acknowledge the figurehead, there's very little, in theory, I welcome shows, any media property, any entity, I welcome the challenge to see what they're going to do next. Last Jedi, for me, suffered from this. The She-Hulk tries to do it. I like the She-Hulk scene where she comes out of she punches through the screen, climbs into the Disney Plus menu, goes down into a different show and talks to the Kevin Feige robot about how her character arc is working out and everything. That's great in isolation if you can do something with it. Obviously, it's acknowledging how formulaic the MCU is. It's acknowledging how much people don't care about what happens. They're just watching it anyway. I think that is a genius move if you can do something brilliant with it. But obviously, the way the MCU is doesn't feel like they've capitalized on that whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, it just reminded me of that because, that was very much Ken Levine. And I remember thinking that, playing through the final bit of Infinite, going, you can never do another one of these.
Yeah.
And if you do, the guy himself is saying, like, is taking the authenticity and taking it out the door with him, kind of thing. But yeah, that was what always fascinated me about the way Infinite wraps up.
Little did we know just how franchises in the video game realm and across culture in general were going to get so safe and so formulaic going forwards. And before we properly wrap this up, Scott, I just want to ask you, because we've talked a lot about games that actually came out before the next generation of consoles here. So I want to ask you, just before we wrap up, like 10 years on from the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One, like, what do you think the legacy of those consoles is now in the games that eventually came out for them?
The PS3 and the 360.
Well, just in general of all, like, consoles, like, where does the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One era land for you? What does it represent? What does 2013 signal the beginning of in this grand video game industry in history of it?
Oh, God.
Big question, isn't it?
A different type of purpose, I guess, because we kind of covered it. But, like, for me, it's like video games were one thing in the 70s and the 80s. They sucked up all your coins in the arcades. And then the 90s, it was like, we're going to experiment with these, with storytelling. Even if it was something like GoldenEye or Metal Gear Solid, Final Fantasy VII, you had all these attempts at bringing storytelling into the games, but they were still very much video games. And then for me, the next turning point after you've got Kojima in the late 90s is the mid-2000s with Naughty Dog and Uncharted. We'd never seen motion capture like that. And if you go back, Uncharted 1 doesn't look that good.
No.
But it did at the time. It looked incredible at the time. And it was like, okay, what are we going to do with this? And then it needed that extra, like, thematic punch that the indie scene brought, and that, like I said, Bioshock went there in terms of fourth wall breaks and player agency, and why are we doing these things? Why are we doing these repetitive tasks? Why do we care about how easy it is to kill in games or whatever it is? It needed that thing to round it all off and then propel it to the next era. I don't know if we need another era. I would want the next advancement of gameplay.
Yeah.
Like, which is kind of like just a raw technical thing of like minimizing loading or whatever it is. But I'm waiting for the industry to show that to me. I need you to show me something on a gameplay level that I couldn't even conceive of.
Yeah.
That's what I'm waiting for. I feel like we've fleshed out thematics. We've done some of the darker stories you could possibly do, whether it's like Dragon Cancer. Or Papers, Please, or whatever. We've done it. Like, we've proven we can do that, and we can nail it, and we can make it immersive and interactive, and you'll be crying or you'll feel shaken at the end of it, like the end of Last of Us 2 or the end of Celeste or whatever. So for me, I'm like, okay, we've proven we can ape Hollywood, and we can beat it. Now what? Like, for me, there was so much in the games media, in the magazines, and just online across the 2010s, about aping Hollywood and beating Hollywood and chasing Hollywood and casting A-listers and all that kind of stuff. And we've done it. We've done all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe now we just make some games.
Hey, my friend, games are still coming out, I'm telling you that.
I love games.
I think it's interesting that you say, like, era there, because for me, and this is just pulling this out of my ass now, I need to think about this probably later, but for me, like, PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, and the respective other consoles that came out along the same time, at the same time, like, that's one era to me. That is a natural progression of ideas and mechanics and technology. And then when you get to the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, obviously there's a continuation in some form, but to me that really does signal the beginning of a new era that we're currently in. Like, the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X generational leap is iterative, and, you know, I've loved a lot of things that have been born from that, but I do think a lot of the ideas are carried on from the break between the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One and those being released, because that was just, again, such a flashpoint, I think, for the industry in general. It was proof that the console model would be around forever, essentially. It was proof that it wasn't going to go away. People were ravenous for this stuff. They were ravenous for storytelling. They were ravenous for indies. They were ravenous for new ideas. They were ravenous for online games. And I think we've been living in that era since, and it makes me wonder what's next. Will there be another cutoff point like it?
It has been like a glossy version of where we left off in 2013.
Yeah,
like, you know, you might make matchmaking sizes can be bigger, 64v64 in Battlefield or whatever, but it's a bigger, more refined version of where we landed in about 2013, when, like you said, the death knell was rung internally, and then it was covered years later about how internally PC was the future and no one cared about consoles.
Yes.
And EA was one of the people saying that and everything. But they could not have been more wrong, like you said. And it's just like, trying to balance that stuff out, trying to get back to a point where budgets are manageable, projects are scopable, which clearly isn't the case right now, whether it be Redfall or you just name any game, it's broken at launch. To me, I want to get back to where we were in terms of well, project size. I don't want to limit creativity. There's a right now as we're recording this, Phil Spencer just did an interview about how Redfall was allowed to release that way. And he just said, I will never compromise the creativity of the studios. Like, they should be able to reach and take their shot. And if they miss, they miss. That's what I love about gaming. But I would love if turnaround was a bit faster, if, you know, if they could execute on a vision without it taking 5 years or 8 years.
Absolutely, absolutely agree. You know, 2013, I think, is an important year because it's got so many great moments, like we just said, but it was also an ending for so many bad practices. You know, you had, like I said, Dead Space 3 proving that EA's model for their franchises just wasn't working. You had big disasters like Alien Colonial Marines. You had big gambles and big bets that kind of came to a head and kind of forced the industry to go, we can't keep doing this. And we're on a similar trajectory now, I think, started by the beginning of the next gen as it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And now we're at this point, like you said there, you know, when we're encountering a lot of the same problems on a bigger scale. And when are we going to get that crash point again? Because it's cynical to say, but things have to crash in the video game space before, you know, people shift ideas. They will take these ideas to breaking point until it stops making the money, until they start becoming a proper laughing stock, and then they have to change kind of tact. They have to change their approach. And I don't think we're quite there yet, but in a cynical way, I feel like we're on that trajectory. For as much as I love the games, those practices, those kind of modes of thinking, those years and years spent in development to produce a game that's buggy at launch and nobody likes, like that's gotta snap at some point, and then we will get maybe the next era, whether that's going to come at the end of the PS5 and the Xbox Series X generation, or whether it's going to extend into the PS6 and whatever the next Xbox is called generation, I don't know, but I feel like that will come at some point. It seems inevitable, like Thanos.
This is such a wider conversation. Sorry, a wider talking point. I don't have all the requisite information for this, but I just wonder if there is an optimum way of making a AAA video game overall, and that is how long it'll take, and that is how pretty something is going to look. Like, every now and then we get a version of a AAA game that didn't take the earth. Like, Jedi Survivor launched with a few patches. It's been patched, with a few bugs. It's been patched now. But Respawn turned that around pretty quick. And they also have been managing Apex and Titanfall 2, and they've been planning whatever their next IP is, according to insiders. Insomniac have turned around an insane amount of games, whether it be Ratchet and Clank or the various Spider-Man games. There was another one as well, but there are various studios who are they're nailing it. And it's like, they're getting there. Like, they're finding a way to, like, have the project scope, have it look beautiful, and have it ready without it costing the earth or breaking half the team in half. They're all in half. But that's the thing. And I'm just like, what lessons can we learn from those teams? And it's like, yeah, you can look at Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart and say it's not, like, the most, innovative thing. It's not pushing the medium forward. But something in that space with that amount of money rarely would anyway. Like, I just wonder about scope creep and all that kind of stuff.
Of course.
And games getting too big for their own good and trying to chase constant growth in every single metric. And instead of, like I said, just making some video games.
What you said there reminds me of something that actually might make you hate 2013, to be honest, because I'm talking about it being a year of beginnings and also a year of endings. 2013 was the last time we saw Naughty Dog and Rockstar be the older version of themselves. Yeah. You always talk about Rockstar, you know, releasing a bunch of games. And in that 3 year period, they released Red Dead Redemption in 2010. They released Max Payne 3 in 2012, and then GTA 5, and then did nothing until Red Dead Redemption 2, which is one of my favorite games of all time. And then nothing since then until GTA 6, presumably. Naughty Dog have been more prolific, but Last of Us, despite being a new franchise then, kind of also railroaded them into a specific set of franchises, kind of in the Rockstar model, where then Last of Us was all they made, apart from the Uncharted game, and now it's like, when's the new IP? So I don't mind that as much as you do, but I just thought it was interesting that that was also the end of that era almost for them.
From Software is the other one that I want to shout out. They have such a solid turnaround, and there are things on the Glassdoor, the website, about the potential reality of how they're turning things around and whether that leads to too much crunch. Obviously, that needs to be investigated further or whatever, but in terms of their turnaround, look at the amount of games, the amount of new IPs that are like Bloodborne, Sekiro, Dark Souls. We're going to get Another Armored Core. Like, they are on fire in the best way right now. And I'm just like, okay, there has to be a model in there that works.
Yes.
Like, if they can turn around Elden Ring after having done Sekiro and Dark Souls 3 and whatever, all within, like, they're all 2 years apart. How are they doing this? And some of it will come down to reusing an engine the same way that Rockstar used to. But that's the thing. If you want to get a little bit sad about the turnaround of the devs that you love, look at Rockstar's output across the 2000s and contrast it with the 2010. because you're going from like 10 games to 3 or 2 or whatever it is. Like, it's just, for me, I've always said I would love like 10 smaller games from the minds of Naughty Dog than one giant one every 8 years.
Yeah.
Like, or every 5 years or whatever it is. It's just not worth that much time for that game. Like, yeah, I would take like 20, like loads of smaller games. Not tiny, not pixel platformers necessarily, but like a Chia or a Sifu or a Hellblade or whatever from those people, rather than putting all these eggs into all these baskets. And if it fails so hard. Over and over and over again.
Listen, this is why I love you. I respect that. I don't agree. I wouldn't want that necessarily.
I know you love all the big stuff.
I love the big opulence, but I also agree that putting all your eggs in a basket when that basket is like Anthem or is like The Division is probably not a good idea.
Is
like,
red and is falling.
Is red and is falling and is what Halo and is Infinite. You know, stuff like that is probably not a good idea. You need to have backups. You need to have the ability to... allow your developers to flex creatively rather than just work on one game for 8 years and then have it like be something that's following market trends like Suicide Squad.
Yeah, sorry, not to jump in. I'm just thinking, like, if there was something where... Because there's a whole thing right now about internally Xbox/Microsoft have said that they're working on a sequel to something that they think will take a decade.
Yeah.
I hate that. I don't want you to sit there for a decade. How much has changed in the last decade?
I think that's
imagine
a good point.
Imagine working on something for 10 years.
That's what I always think is crazy. You know, when Halo Infinite came out, ignoring the issues that game had. Like, that game's ambitions of being a Halo that will survive for 10 years. Mm. We are now 10 years out from 2013. And while we're saying that the industry, you know, is following the seeds of things that were laid then, things have changed a lot in the past 10 years. Like, the gaming space is so rapid in its evolutions and its technological revolutions that I don't know how you can plan for 10 years in a video game space with one game. I mean,
the Destiny plan didn't work.
Yeah. Unless you're GTA 5, which was a fluke in and of itself, by the way. It's just impossible.
There's that side of it. There's the trend side of it. There's also, what creative vision do you need 10 years to map out for? Yeah. Like, and again, I obviously side with the Phil Spencers of the world saying I'd put money behind a creative vision. It might be the next best thing in the world that someone might experience. But at the same time, what I just think the sheer size that the industry's got to, where the expectation is that if you want to make a game on the toppest upper echelon, that's 3 to 5 years of your life minimum. That's kind of nuts.
Hey.
Like, that's kind of crazy.
Microsoft want to enter the era of the quadruple A game. So unfortunately, I think that's the future of our lives, at least in the short term, until that proves to be
tire fire. That's for the reboot of Perfect Dark. Apparently, they can't even decide on what that game is. The last insider report for that was that they can't even decide if it's first or third person.
It's so funny.
Good.
Like, I know a video. This is not me being facetious or anything like that. Video game development is really hard, but it's always striking to me when you read a report from the development of a troubled game in how little people know what that game is going to be, even while they're making it. You know, you look at the original report from, I think it's Jason Schreier's Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, his book, where he chronicles the development of Destiny and how much of that game was thrown out 6 months, 9 months before it was set to release. People didn't know if it was going to be third person, first person, what, you know. Anthem, obviously, famously, Mass Effect Andromeda, no one really knew the scope of that game, what it was going to be. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how video game development is so unwieldy now that no one even really knows what they're making until it's like a year before launch and then they're scrambling to do all the missions for it.
That's kind of the auteur thing, because I cannot recommend the Double Fine documentaries enough. The most recent one on Psychonauts 2 is a great look into that, because they have to keep relying on Tim Schafer. But he's not available because he's writing scripts or he's not in the office or whatever it is. And there are so many design teams going like, do I take the initiative with this? I have no idea. Like, they're trying to go off this master document that he's not even finished yet.
Mm.
So it's like the idea of, like, I remember the guy from Bungie when they were making Halo 2 saying it's like jumping out of a plane and stitching the parachute on the way down. And you'll either get there or you'll just hit the floor. And which is a Bullet for My Valentine reference. But that's still, that's a very good song. Yeah. But that's kind of the thing with game dev, is that you do need that focus. And you can tell which games have that focus and which ones don't, for the vast majority. Like, I think that all that stuff it started in 2013 and exploded from there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to end maybe on a positive, I'd again point out Jedi Survivor. You know,
yes.
That game has bugs, but the core of it it feels like the people who made it knew what they wanted to make.
Absolutely.
From the get-go. It's like, we have a vision for what this can be. Maybe I'm entirely wrong. Maybe they just worked a miracle right at the very end, but I'd be very surprised because that thing is so focused for a triple-A game especially. It's so good. It's so laser-focused on what it wants to deliver, and it delivers it with the exception of water, which tanks the game into 5 frames per second. God damn it, Respawn. Let me love it.
Hey, it might be patched by now, but I tell you what the marker for... There's two things here. One, Mike Bithell from Bithell Games just made the Neutron game, which I forgot what the hell that thing's called, but it's a Neutron game. Bithell also made Thomas Was Alone and Volume. He said, if you want to look at how much time someone was allowed to perfect a video game, look at the toilets. He had this whole thing, and I think it started as a joke, but he mentioned it on one of the old podcasts with Alana Pierce and Troy Baker and Austin Wintry, that if you look at a game's toilets, how much effort has gone into that? Can you interact with them? What shape are they? How much geometry do they have? Like, are they refined? Like, he was like, it started as a stupid thing, but you need something as pointless as that to let you know whether they were allowed to, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's. Second thing is Ewan, who's returned to our culture after a little vacation at the old Screen Rant. We were talking to him about Jedi Survivor because he's in the office now. And there's a trophy in that game, no spoilers, but if you pull off a certain combat move involving a drop kick, you'll get a trophy. And I was like, that level of rewarding you for such specificity is very rare. Like, I feel like I see that in Insomniac stuff, but very, very rare.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned Jedi Survivor and Mike Bithell's toilet comment, because you can also go into the toilet in Jedi Survivor. You can unblock it. You can wash your hands, and you, get a trophy there as well. So that's the perfect example. I've just hit my microphone with my water bottle. I'm very excited that I've made that connection.
That's hilarious.
It sums it up. That's great, isn't it? I know. Yeah.
Because I would treat Survivor as a game that was allowed to be curated and crafted and given the time in the oven. You can directly contrast it with Redfall.
Yeah.
Something that doesn't have a focus and did just get kicked out the door or whatever. But yes, for now, this has been our retrospective on the year 2013. We'll do some more of these.
We will.
Because there's good years in gaming history. 2007 comes to mind.
15 was great.
Yeah. 2015 was ridiculous. 2015 was incredible. 1997, I'm a big fan of. 1998 as well.
1999, yeah.
And the 2000, pretty much all of them. But we'll see how we go. But yeah, massive thank you to everybody for listening. This has been the What Culture of Gaming podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. And we'll catch you later in the week.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Lovely.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.